Welcome to Women Who Move Nations, the podcast about women in transport and mobility. I'm your host, Michelle Batsis, Executive Director of UITP, the International Association of Public Transport here in Australia and New Zealand. We're raising the voices of women for everyone who works in transport and mobility, and particularly any young women listening out there who are early in their transport careers and looking for inspiration. This episode of Women Who Move Nations is hosted by Andrzej Anczewska, our superstar general manager of UITP in Australia and New Zealand. I hope you enjoy Andrzej's interview with Megan Burke O'Neill, and I'll be back next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Women Who Move Nations, the public transport podcast. I'm Andrzej Anczewska, and I am delighted to welcome our next guest, Megan Burke O'Neill, the Deputy Secretary of Policy and Innovation at the Victorian Department of Transport. Hi, Megan. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Andrzej. It's really great to be here.
To start off with, can you give us an overview of your current role and the Department of Transport's priorities?
Well, my role, as you said, is Deputy Secretary of Policy and Innovation. And I mean, they're two words used quite a lot in and around government and in transport. And I tend to think that title is a little bit deceptive because my role also involves long-term strategy for transport, but also some very active initiatives happening now on the network and oversight of operations in some key areas. So it's quite diverse. I would say the overall focus of my entire group in transport is on improving and transforming services. And that might be with a long-term outlook, but as I've mentioned, is also about changing things now. So we're very involved in the development, testing, trialing, and scaling of new service models, improvements, and initiatives that really progress transport now, as in tomorrow, as well as looking at a sort of a 5 to 10 year outlook. In a nutshell, very quickly, I've got four major areas. The first is commercial strategy and commercial design for the state's major private sector partnerships. And Victoria is one of the most privatised systems in the world. Our train, tram and metropolitan bus services are delivered by private sector partners. And we also have some major new infrastructure that will come on stream into its operational phases in the coming 10 years. So that's a fairly complex network and integration task that really does require fresh thinking and new thinking about the commercial arrangements that will support that. And this area is also looking at new mobility and the range of new services and innovations that will present different commercial opportunities and challenges. It's a really important part of the department's work and overseeing a pipeline of commercial transactions coming up for us in the order of $23 billion over that time period. As well as that, the next area I lead is strategy, innovation and data insights. A really key area for us because this is where we're developing some really exciting new functions. Firstly, it is the part of the department that's developing our long-term transport strategy and customer strategy. We are now, and this probably answers the second part of your question, Andrzej, also working with government on six key focus areas for the development of transport now and into the future. And they speak to areas like transforming our network and services to make the most of our new infrastructure, our big build program, enabling new travel patterns, particularly as is arising from the experience we've all had with the pandemic, and more embedded working from home and flexibility expectations, and transitioning to environmentally sustainable transport. The six focus areas also speak a bit to how we work. So we're definitely prioritising more emphasis on testing and trialling new innovations, to complement that sort of traditional public sector work of developing business cases and long-term sort of planning as well. So that's the first part of strategy, innovation and data insights. We've also introduced a new innovation program in the department, overseen by our entire DOT leadership and our secretary, Paul Yunus. And I might speak to a little bit more about that later because in its first year of operations, it's delivered some really exciting new initiatives out onto the network already. And then I have the transport analysis and modelling area, really crucial. This area has played a huge role during COVID. It's about sharing the network's performance understanding how each mode is performing and movement on the network. So a bit of a today issue, as well as modeling capability to tell us what transport can look like in the future, both what we've committed to already through government's major transport agenda, but different scenarios for the future to help inform our future policy and planning. The third area is a big policy area, and this is where our portfolio's transport legislation and regulation is developed from, as well as some really significant public policy sort of areas for transport, things like environmental sustainability and transport's response to the government's Climate Change Act and emissions commitments, accessible transport, market reforms, safety, including personal safety. So some really big, discrete, but super important policy pieces done from that area, as well as fares and pricing and national reform. The final part of my space kind of spans not just policy, strategy and innovation, but into some operational oversight and industry work, which is ports and freight. And our Victorian department is on a real journey with starting to look at how well we're serving both passenger and freight movement across the board. I lead Freight Victoria, and they have a crucial role as the conduit for industry into the department, and in partnership with industry, and there's also a lot of Commonwealth work here as well. We oversee commercial and local ports, the lease of the Port of Melbourne, and work on freight, road and rail initiatives in conjunction with other colleagues in the department. So it's a really diverse area. And as I've mentioned it, the six focus areas we have for transport, future transport, really speak to the department's priorities and to how we'll execute our purpose statement, which is simple, safe, connected journeys.
Well, Megan, every time I hear you talk about the vast responsibilities that you have and the diverse portfolio that you look after, I'm just wowed and amazed. And I want to unpack probably some of your personal approach to staying on top of all of that as a part of this podcast. But before we do that, you did mention as a part of your remit, policy and innovation, what kind of innovations is DOT looking at? And maybe if you could share also what's very top of mind for a lot of us, how has COVID impacted those priorities?
Yes, well, the department, we came together as a fully integrated department in 1 July 2019, and I commenced my role in September 2019, and innovation's in my title. So one of the first things that I did with our secretary and our entire leadership, and then many layers in the organisation as well, is unpack what is innovation in transport, what are the opportunities and priorities, and what does it mean to work innovatively on transport problems. And we came together around an agenda, and this is all pre-COVID. A lot of innovation does happen already in our service operations area, right through to policy, but we wanted to prioritise bringing a different working method and more focus on outside expertise, partnering with the private sector. We wanted to bring a new approach to some of our biggest, most integrated but difficult transport problems. So pre-COVID, we committed as a leadership team to starting this new program, to standing up agile working, to asking a team of people to come together from different backgrounds and disciplines and work on with no preconceived notions about the solutions. We started with two of our biggest problems. We chose congestion, congested services, congested roads, and we chose real-time information for customers. As it turned out, they were two problems that were so relevant to work on as we faced the challenges presented by COVID. Long story short, but in terms of real-time data, our work on that front through the innovation process and then through a more specific rapid approach with the private sector has allowed us to fix some of our gaps and our problems with data and real-time information with five private sector partners, and then be able to introduce onto the network from 1 February this year, timed with our new public transport timetable, as well as our off-peak fare discount, which were also developed through my policy area, we introduced our new real-time crowding solution onto the Metro train network called Ride Space, and we've made that available through the PTV app and through other websites across Victorian government. And this allows people to be able to see in real time when services are arriving and how busy or not those services are, a really key element of our approach to support people and their choices about journey times to have as much distance and space as possible in response to COVID. So in doing that, in being able to fix our data and make that possible through RideSpace, we were also, and this just happened in the last couple of weeks, able to, for the first time, provide a data feed to Google that they could use. And they've now incorporated our crowding solutions into Google Maps functionality, as well as some really cool innovations of their own. And that's now available to people. And that's hugely important as well, when we know that around 62% of people use Google Maps for their journey planning. So I'm not sure that we would have progressed as far as we have if we hadn't have adopted a new approach and really pulled the portfolio together to say, what are the barriers and problems here and how can we work it differently? And then have a big kick on of urgency as a result of COVID. So that was the first problem that we worked with. The other innovation, the other focus area, congestion, well, as with every transport jurisdiction, the COVID challenges presented to us two almost competing problems, which was particularly during stages of the pandemic for Melbourne last year, it's important that services aren't too crowded, public transport services, but equally, mode shift to roads will present very congested road networks. We started to look at all of the solutions around road congestion, road space and congested services through this process. And some of the deliverables we've had is government's commitment to our $380 million road space initiative, creating more road space, which is a combination of placing more technology onto the existing road network, better incident response, and more responsiveness to intersection blocking and managing our clearways better. That was a combination of the innovation team's work as well as some really fantastic work done in the previous Vic Roads about an approach that really looks to a technology-led way of managing traffic congestion, and that came together through the course of last year as well. Finally, my last comment would be that we're continuing to look at innovating service models. We have scaled up some more on-demand bus trials. We're looking to do more of that in regional Victoria as well as a number of other things. And we'll tackle our next two big challenges shortly by forming these innovation teams again, this time also looking at faster, more reliable freight access, a big challenge in the urban environment, and first last mile connections.
Thanks, Megan. I appreciate you sharing what I think is a very sophisticated approach to the innovation piece of the portfolio. And that's really bringing in all parts of the department, workshopping it and saying across the various areas in the department, there is expertise, recognizing that and having then those stakeholders pitch solutions really, and then try to implement them instead of just, you know, holding on to that innovation in one area. So I think that's a credit to you, and that really has strengthened some of the outcomes that we've seen from the department. Over the past year, just sticking with COVID a bit more, the pandemic has created a number of opportunities and challenges for leaders. And we've had a few discussions over the past year, you and I, and one of the things that stuck with me during one of our conversations is that you said you found addressing the morale and resilience of your team to be a critical need. What have been the key factors to lead a team, and what inspiring stories have you heard during these times?
It's such an important topic, Anjay, and I don't know that I've done it brilliantly. Like I look back on and I can reflect on where I think I should have invested more time and more focus, but I think it was such an evolving situation. So I think in the beginning, the transition to working from home, I think there was some surprise that we did transition in the main pretty well, and an initial sense of, isn't this exciting? And then of course, the length of that and the awareness of how everyone's individual circumstances meant there were very different experiences going on, meant that we had to take a really nuanced approach. Just very quickly, if I think of two obvious issues, there were those that were dealing with young children and homeschooling and how challenging that was on top of very demanding jobs. And then also those living alone and the impact of particularly Melbourne's extended lockdown on people's mental health and the fact that they hadn't had human interaction and human touch for months on end. And they were two very big issues where, as my leadership group and the department's leadership group, we worked on strategies to support people. But I also found that I needed to make time, as did, you know, I think all the people leaders in the department, to really understand where particular individuals were at and give my time to being, to listening to them and what they need. And is under the public service, understandably, had to shift to a 24/7 operation to support the government's response to this pandemic. And that is required out of leaders and teams, and some of them in my area in particular, for certain reasons, were working 7 days a week. It required such grit, such commitment and acceptance of this new reality and this kind of determination to keep going, even when it was very, very exhausting and at times quite stressful. And I think for myself, I also had to make that commitment very quickly in myself that this is what this is, and this is so important. The public service right now is so important. What we do and what we need to figure out in our work with industries affected, either closing or needing to stay open, as most of transport did, in terms of how restrictions are impacting people, it was so important just to make that commitment. This is what it is, and keep going. But I've had to deploy also on top of that, as much as I can, different ways of giving people breaks that's not always taking leave, different arrangements for standing up, you know, people shadowing people and people taking downtime and all sorts of creative ways of keeping that entire show going. And it's been so important. My last comment on this would be how you lead a team. Where it's still a young department, we're not even 2 years of being fully integrated for the first time in Victorian transport. And I don't think our culture and our approach, our ways of working would have advanced as far as they can, and we have a long way to go. But if we hadn't had the pandemic, I'm immensely proud of how we came together and the way that the different areas of the department supported one another. I have an amazing set of colleagues and the other deputy secretaries, and I think it accelerated our sense of who we are and how we operate, how we need to serve our three transport ministers, and how we need to work as a department. So it's been a challenging leadership experience, but it's also been very exciting.
Yeah, we talk a lot about resilience and innovation within our transport networks, but to hear it as applied to the leadership style, I think is very refreshing to have an opportunity really to live those values. I want to hear more about your professional journey and how that's influenced your leadership style. So you started out studying social work at Victoria University. How did you end up working in transport, and how does your social work background help or influence the decisions you make as a leader?
Yes, well, they don't, on the face of it, appear to have much in common, do they? I've worked in the not-for-profit sector initially in social work, but then also in government in statutory child protection and family services, family law areas. The work that you do with children and families in those service systems gives you a lot of exposure to an understanding of disadvantage and the impact of disadvantage on individual children and families, obviously, but also the structural and social arrangements of our lives and how that makes a real difference in people's lives. Access to participate in jobs, in services, in life is such a big issue, and access is driven by good transport. So I had in my work when I was doing direct service delivery really noticed that the ability to get around, seek out opportunities in employment, education, the ease at which you can do that and live your life is really affected by transport. through my 10 or so years in that sort of service system, I was really became quite interested in more the policy structural side and how you run service systems. And that was enhanced further when I actually led a pretty major child protection operation in the Grampians region of Victoria. So that's from Melton onto the South Australian border. That allowed me to work with really large service systems, including the police and the courts, and to understand and experience how you lead major operations. So how you develop workforces, as well as make improvements to service systems. And I really did learn how to work hard during that job, I should say too, but also how important it is to care for yourself and have a happy life whilst doing a big job. So that taught me about running operations, and that's important in transport as well. My transition into transport was I did feel that I wanted to work in one of the big economic and infrastructure portfolios. So that led me to choose transport. That was in around 2009, and I've had some moves in and out since. I've kept up what seems to be my theme of my working life of doing some really diverse things. But coming into transport allowed me to then work in an area that has such an impact on disadvantage, but also on the economy and socially, and is citizen-wide impact. And I've really loved it since. I carry with me that understanding of how important we only do this so that we can improve people's quality of life, and that real commitment to the outcome is for the person, the business. And I carry that with me from my earlier days in social policy.
It sounds like that social work background well prepared you for what it is you're responsible for now. And we like to say at UITP that transport should move people, not cars. So that connection between people and the social equity and social justice aspects of what public transport provide just really shine through. I'd love to know what you enjoy most about working in public transport and infrastructure.
Yeah, well, I think that it's about the impact, you know, you're having at a big picture sort of level in terms of how cities work and regions work and communities work. And that's very satisfying. But it's also, it's such a pragmatic portfolio too. We're running big transport services. We're adjusting and reshaping those all the time, whilst our colleagues over in major transport infrastructure projects led by Corey Hannett are transforming the system. So it's a very complex world that we work in, and it requires lots of decisions every day and practical things to be done on the network every day. So you have big challenges, but you see things changing now as well as what you can see you're developing for the future and over the horizon. And I think I find that combination makes it really satisfying, really challenging, but also very satisfying.
It's really inspiring to hear how leaders like you and really all of our guests on the series are so passionate about public transport. It's really an industry that once people are in it, they want to stay around for a long time because it's so dynamic and plays such an important role in our communities. You spoke about the service delivery changes that you made in the Grampians, and one of your first roles in transport was as Chief Executive Officer of the Victorian Taxi Services Commission. You served in this role from 2010 to 2012 at a time where that industry was going through a huge change in the market with deregulation and the emergence of rideshare services in Australia. How did you approach such a big reform?
Yes, it definitely is and was a big reform and continues to be evolving as a reform piece too. This was right at that time period you're referring to, 2010 to 2012. Coming into the market were the beginnings of those disruptive service models, the beginnings of ride sharing. But what had occupied governments and industries for decades had been the impact of closed markets, supply restrictions. So at that period in time, there was a limited number of taxi licenses available, and they had gained their own asset worth and traded on a secondary market like a private investment. And that had meant that as an investment class, people could buy them or rent them. And taxi operators rented them, paid huge annual fees to the owners of those licenses, and there was very little revenue left for drivers and service delivery. So there were very big structural challenges in that industry. And for some participants in the industry, a strong agenda around retaining a closed market. It had been an area I think the government wanted to reform and was seeking to reform for some time, but it was really at that time the declining service levels. You couldn't, if you remember, Andre, you could not get a taxi on a Saturday night for hours. You would just sit on the phone, is how we used to book them in those days, to an engaged tone. And that was often the case too in regional towns. And so there were big problems. And then there was this just looming disruption. So it was a big reform. The government of the day committed to looking end to end to that industry, but we knew that it would have to be a feasible reform. It would have to look at this issue of, well, is government going to change policy so significantly to affect the asset value of these investors? And for some of them, they were in the industry as well. They were actually operating companies and fleets. So I knew two things at the outset. I would need a high performing team with multiple disciplines. So economic regulation, service understanding, industry understanding, and forming that team was really important, getting the combination right. I worked to the commissioner overseeing the reform, who is Alan Fells. He is a known competition reformer and also a brilliant person, really great person, but also a brilliant mind and brilliant at working with governments and in the media as well. And just really understanding it would take quite a sophisticated response to those challenges. And in the end, because ride sharing did enter even further, then moving into this government in their last term, they actually adopted what is still, I think, Australia's most progressive set of reforms, which was to remove the aspects of regulation that were about limiting supply, to embrace ride sharing services, but to put in place regulation that would make it safe and customer centric, no matter whether they're traditional taxis or ride sharing services, and introduce that framework. And that also meant offering structural adjustment and hardship to some industry members who were affected.
Absolutely. And I think that the approach really is so unique that it's used as a global example the world over about how to approach such services. It's a fascinating topic, and we recognize that UITP, that shared mobility and other solutions, including walking and cycling, are part of that public transport umbrella, especially for the first and last mile of people's journeys, if we want to get more people out of their private cars. So with all of that experience, a little crystal ball gazing, what do you think the future of the commercial passenger vehicle industry looks like? Will there always be a role for unbooked services such as taxis, as well as rideshare services like Uber?
I think there will be a role for unbooked services, and in particular in CBDs or locations where it's convenient to still hail from a street. So I think so there, but I think we will continue to see even more diversity of services emerging in this market, more niche services. And we've started to see that in Melbourne already. Because of our reforms, we have four of the five biggest global players are here offering services and in the ride-sharing space. But we also have some really cool local initiatives. A service called Shiva, which focuses on transporting women and children only. We have a couple of companies offering green options, and we're very interested in that and how that will evolve. And for some of us as users of these services, it matters to us. So if we can afford it and we want to choose, we can already afford to take a CPV trip, maybe there's other things that we really value. And traveling in a low emissions or zero emissions vehicle is something that we may choose to do. So I think we'll see more of that diversity and niche service offerings, which is exciting, and potentially some crossover with on-demand services. And we'll keep seeing more technology and safety improvements as well.
Megan, I've got to say that I've personally been very inspired by you and the work that you lead and your story. And one thing I can say for certain from personal experience is that your energy is really contagious. And it got me thinking about the need for role models. And I want to ask you, how important do you think it is for young women to have a female role model they can look up to and aspire to be?
Oh, it's really important. It's essential to for young women and young people to have role models in organisations. And I would say it's just as important for us that are in leadership roles to be working directly with young women and young people. And what I mean by that is it's almost like sort of reverse mentoring. We need to understand the perspective of young people coming into organisations and young women coming into organisations, the experience they're having and the kinds of things that are working and not working from their perspective, because that is the workforce that will start to take over and emerge as the leaders. And so sometimes I think we assume that relationship is, and an important part is, talking about what we've learned, what we reflect on, what might be helpful in the progression of young people in a field like transport. But equally, we need to be challenged by the perspective and view young people are bringing into organisations. And one of the most topical, I think, most important discussions we'll be having right now is about inclusion and representation. And I think representation means having people, a much bigger, more diverse group of people participating in decision making and leadership than we have. I'm very aware that whilst I know that I've worked hard in my career and that I do have skills to offer, I also know as a now middle-aged English speaking white woman, part of the reason I'm here is that I've had privileges that others haven't had, and that I'm not exceptional. Other people could do what I do, but I've probably had a pathway that's been somewhat easier than other people. So I think it's very important that representation is worked on in organisations. And to understand that, we need to understand the perspective of younger people coming in and people of different backgrounds coming in as well. So I think it's very important to be the sort of leader that's prepared to share your experiences and what has worked and hasn't worked professionally, but is also open to hearing and learning and continuing to educate yourself and bringing that to the leadership table as well.
I really do appreciate you sharing that, Megan. I think that it would be important for us to have leadership in public transport that's reflective of, you know, our users, our customers, people who ride the network, because all of those perspectives are valid and can contribute to making something truly great within our networks.
You just said that so much better than I could, Anjay. I totally agree.
You're one of the most senior women in public transport in Australia. What do you feel has been the key to your success in being able to achieve your professional goals?
So this one, I am asked about this, or I am having conversations with people about it. And there are some really obvious things to point to in terms of key to success, which is about obviously working hard, developing skills, but also delivering something that is, you know, end to end, a really difficult piece of work and going through the different experiences of that. It might be technically challenging. It might be difficult to win support from. It might present some wins and losses or consequences that make it difficult to get up. It might present some policy and political challenges at decision-making level. Being able to be involved through the highs and lows of a piece of work like that will really help you to grow. And that has been key to some of my success. But what I really think it's about in terms of being able to achieve your professional goals is actually knowing yourself and learning that you are not your job, you're not your work, you're not your achievements or where you live or anything else. Mm. You really need to know who you are, what makes you happy, what makes you happy when you wake up in the morning, and what makes your heart sing, and what you need to feel good as you go about life in your most important things, your relationships with people and the things you enjoy doing. And I found for me, knowing that about myself means that I can commit to my work wholeheartedly and really work hard and enjoy it, but carry it lightly as well, not let it become, because they are hard and big jobs, but carry it lightly, still find that happiness and enjoyment in life even when you are working that hard. So it's knowing yourself and never ever choosing a job for a title or a progression, but choosing the thing that you know you really think is interesting and you care about, and then you will work on it wholeheartedly.
Absolutely. I found that to be true as well. And there's so many interesting and exciting things about transport too. So it makes it just a little bit easier in our industry, I would say.
Okay.
It's interesting to hear about how different senior women approach their careers and find that balance and that happiness that you speak of. In terms of your own career progression and knowing yourself, are you someone who works with a 5 to 10 year plan, or do you harness the opportunities that come your way?
It's definitely the latter. I have never had a plan, and I really just focus on the work and whether it speaks to something that I think I've got the skills for, or I'd like to, I've got just enough and I'm prepared to develop further, where I think I can have an impact, and the nature of that role and what it contains really speaks to me. And then I'll commit to it for that period of time. But then there is also the opportunities that come your way, but it's still about evaluating those against, is this something where I think I can make a big contribution? The other factor too is the team. So I should have said, in terms of success, I do think it's great teams, because mm-hmm. you're never delivering anything on your own in transport. Yep. You are always doing that in partnership with others. And so it's the opportunity to perform, to be with great people and to develop a high performing team has also been a big factor in opportunities I've taken, or maybe opportunities I've also declined.
Speaking of a team dynamic, you're also on the UITP ANZ board, which is a team in and of itself. And we know that one of the challenges is often the perception that women don't have the skills or experience to serve in those senior board positions. Can you share with us what that experience has been like, and maybe a piece of advice that you have for other women who eventually want to serve on boards?
Yes, I'm really excited to be on the UITP ANZ board, and I have had a bit of experience with other boards and chaired a board, but this for me is like you are with a group of people, heads of transport authorities and, you know, other transport leaders, and we're overseeing and working with your organisation on today, which is growing and changing too in its role. I think it's on a real trajectory of growth and strengthening its reputation as a trusted facilitator of knowledge and ideas and learnings from our part of the world and also all around the world. So it's a real privilege to be on it. I know people use that phrase, but it really is. And I know I will benefit from it, but what I want to contribute to it too is to support that growth. And that's some of the most important work you do as a board member. It's the governance and direction setting for the organisation that you as a group are responsible for and making decisions on. My advice to women wanting to get into boards is to think about doing some training in this area. So I did, several years ago now, the company director's course to make sure I could understand and distinguish between private sector boards and government boards, but also, and there's some crossover in the responsibilities, but also a framework for governance of boards and the kinds of skills, requirements and decisions that you'll be taking around not just that strategic direction setting and an appetite for risk, but also the nuts and bolts of the fiduciary duties and the kinds of decisions you'll be taking. So that really set me up well to have a framework that I could use when I've joined the UITP board.
Yes, I've taken that course as well recently, and it really does give you some insight into all the various aspects of what it does take to be an effective board member. And it's more than just showing up. It is making that positive contribution. And we certainly appreciate yours that you've made on our board. Megan, is there anything really that I haven't covered that you'd like to make a comment on, or any last words that you'd like to share?
I think we've managed to cover quite a bit of ground, haven't we, Anjé? And it's been a really lovely discussion with you. And I so enjoy working with UITP ANZ. I think I'd probably just finish with saying it is a great time to be in transport. I think for us right across Australia and in this region, we're all going through major step change infrastructure investment to keep up with population. We're all working with complex legacy systems. We're all looking at the trends that are impacting us right now around more sustainable transport, more technology-led and easy to use and personalized transport. And I think we're all becoming much better at and unpacking what it really means to be customer-centric in how we develop transport and, quite frankly, keeping pace with rising customer expectations. So when you combine all of that together, it is quite a moment to be in transport. And I see it as a real purpose-led field. It's about quality of life. So I think if I'm seeking to inspire people about transport, that's my main message. And for younger people who might be, you know, fantastic in technology and data analytics or contemplating a career in engineering or even and planning, which is a fantastic part of transport to be in, I encourage them, rather than looking at other industries, to look at this one, because you will feel that sense of purpose every day in your work, as well as develop some highly sought after skills in a growing field.
I love it. So all of you bright, beautiful minds out there, come work for people like Megan Burke O'Neill. That is wonderful. We'll wrap up there. Megan, I want to say a big thank you for taking the time to be our guest on Women Who Move Nations and sharing your journey and insights with our listeners. It's been an incredible pleasure interviewing you for this episode.
Thank you so much, Andre. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Megan Burke O'Neill, the Deputy Secretary of Policy and Innovation at Victoria's Department of Transport. I'm Anja Yanchevska. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you to everyone for listening to this week's episode of Women Who Move Nations. This series is co-produced by Cassandra Kadelka and Lara Rudd, with copywriting by Sophia Dickinson. Please join us each week as we raise the voices of women in the public transport and mobility sector. I'm Michelle Batsis. Keep safe and keep our nations moving.